in New York City, thousands now are dead. It was Arab terrorists, this is what you said. Well, if that is the truth, then what have you got to hide? What were you doing on the day all those people died? Where the f*** were the fighter jets ordered by the FAA? What is your explanation for what you were heard to say when you told the Air Force to stand down, not to intercept? Did you plan to let it happen, or are you just inept? There's some distressing information, sir, which I think should be explained. Just which things have been lost and just what has been gained. Like the thousands of put options bought days before the crash. If the money were collected, it'd make quite a pretty stash. And the only stocks they bought were American and United. Deutsche Bank knows the answer, but the names have not been cited. And is it just coincidence that this firm in the private sector was once run by Fuzzy Krongard, now CIA director? And I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Lusitania, or another Reichstag fire?
Yeah, that's a question that's still unanswered and still worth asking. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO here in Portland, Oregon. That's Dave Rovick's song Reichstag Fire. And last weekend, February 27th, was in fact the 72nd anniversary of the burning of the Reichstag fire in Germany, which allowed Adolf Hitler to fully consolidate his power. And the rest there is sort of history. There's a good piece online called When Democracy Failed, The Warnings of History by Tom Hartman, all about the Reichstag fire with modern parallels. I believe you can find it at commondreams.org. So my name's Andrew Geller, and we're going to be coming back to a favorite topic of mine in a sense. That being the events and investigation of the September 11th attacks in New York and Washington. And my guest this morning is Kyle Hentz. He is the co-founder of 9/11 Citizens Watch and a board member of 911truth.org. Welcome back to the airwaves here, Kyle.
Hey, thanks, Andrew.
Now, there's been a whole bunch of stuff that's happened since I last spoke about the issue of 9/11, and we're going to try and cover as many of them as possible, but not to kind of superficially address them. So we'll see what we can get to. I think probably the biggest news, at least in terms of the mainstream media, has been the release of the so-called hidden 9/11 Commission report that was available in a classified form in August of last year, but was not released to the public. I guess it was just about a month ago or so, and this had to do with all those warnings that the government said they never actually got about terrorism. How do you feel, Kyle, the release of these documents has bolstered the case for a true, full investigation?
I think it's greatly bolstered the case. But before I get into that, I should say that this is a what they call a monograph. And the commission issued a series of staff statements leading up to and became incorporated into the 9/11 report, which became a bestseller. But the monograph, for some reason, was separated out from the 9/11 report rather than being vetted as the rest of it was by the White House counsel in advance, so that they just basically produced a report that showed no redactions or censorship. They separated this report out, and so the question remains, why did they do that? And was it an element with inside the commission that refused to have it vetted the way the rest of the report was? We just don't know right now. But essentially, that document makes the case for us that, and proves the case that, in fact, the government did receive extensive warnings and were processing those warnings through various intelligence agencies and then passing them on to, in this case, the FAA. There were a little over 100 warnings about terrorist activity and plans to strike both overseas and domestically, and 52 of them mentioned Osama bin Laden or al-Qaeda, and some of them mentioned suicide attacks, although apparently specifically not planes used as weapons in suicide attacks.
Let me read here real briefly from a letter dated February 10th to Tom Davis, the chairman of the Committee on Government Reform, from Henry Waxman, the ranking minority member in Congress, and Carolyn Maloney, another member of Congress. Regarding that, as you mentioned, there were 52 intelligence reports that the FAA received that mentioned Osama bin Laden or al-Qaeda prior to September 11, 2001, specifically by name, and that the FAA warned airports that if, quote, the intent of the hijackers is not to exchange hostages for prisoners, but to commit suicide in a spectacular explosion, a domestic hijacking would probably be preferable. And that's important because one of the issues that the FAA, the FBI, the Department of Defense, and NORAD in their own way have all said, we just didn't think this would originate domestically. And NORAD took that one step further to even falsely claim that they're not supposed to look at domestic airspace.
Right. I mean, they made the absurd claim during hearings, which our group, 9/11 Citizens Watch, attended every one of them. But they made the absurd claim that their radar systems were faced outwards, that is, towards the sea for an external threat, like i.e. Russia, a Cold World kind of stance that they were still taking at the time of September 11th. And that is just, I mean, it's a farce. It's absurd. I mean, everyone knows that radar travels in a circle. You know, it sweeps in 360 degrees. So if it's projecting out at sea several hundred miles and picking up ship traffic, potential attack from the air by a bomber or what have you, that sweep continues and looks inland as well. And that's even setting aside for a second, Andrew, the fact that that the most protected airspace in the world is that around the Pentagon and the nation's capital. So it's just patently absurd, and they must think the American people quite dull and empty in terms of what they have in their head to think that they're going to buy and believe this excuse. But the fact is, these warnings came through, and the focus, very interesting, is all on the FAA. Oh, well, the FAA got these warnings.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. Someone inside the intelligence agencies received these warnings, and these would have been brought through the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice. They would have been brought to her attention, and then they're vetted, and they're sort of, you know, basically reviewed and then put in a form that can be delivered to, in this case, the FAA. So all of the focus, and of course the media just follows blindly and says, oh, well, the FAA, why didn't they do more? Why did they take the Sky Marshals off the planes in 2001 if they were getting all these warnings? Well, wait a minute. We need to look at what Rice said to us. Did she perjure herself when she said no one could have imagined, you know, that someone would have taken these planes and blah, blah, blah? You know, well, clearly in her position as National Security Advisor on the National Security Council, that she would have been privy to the warnings that were flowing into the intelligence agency from overseas, from our own apparatus, and reviewed them. So this, quite rightly, Representative Waxman from California, who's calling for hearings in the House Government Reform Committee, has quite rightly raised this as a question. Did she lie to the American people when she testified under oath before the 9/11 Commission and said, you know, I did not see any warnings about planes as weapons? And if I might just go a little bit further and say that the evidence that she certainly did, all you have to do is look at what the president said when asked about the August 6th presidential daily briefing. He replied that he had gotten intelligence. He mentioned the Genoa summit, where the G8 got together that summer, the summer of 2001. They all slept offshore on aircraft carrier because of a threat posed by a plane used as a weapon, perhaps loaded with explosives, that they thought Osama bin Laden behind it would crash into the G8 summit site. So Dr. Rice was there with the president at that time. Clearly, she was aware of the threat posed by planes as weapons and may have perjured herself before the 9/11 commission.
Well, and it seems like a minor thing, but I've got a couple of title pages here in front of me from government documents, Office of Justice Programs at the U.S. Department of Justice, regarding emergency response to acts of terrorism. And the front photograph of this shows two extraordinarily tall-looking towers above the rest of a cityscape skyline with a bullseye target on roughly the floors in which the actual attacks occurred in the World Trade Center. And I don't know if there's any sort of just strange connection there, but it seems sort of odd that, you know, they can claim on the one hand they don't know anything about this, and yet here's the Department of Justice putting out, you know, World Trade Center-looking towers on a document talking about emergency response to terrorism with a bullseye or with crosshairs.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway. I mean, I think the evidence is in. They did know. It's been well documented in Paul Thompson's book, The Terror Timeline, which is out on HarperCollins. You can find it online at cooperativeresearch.org. He goes through all the litany of warnings. Some of them are quite specific. Sibel Edmonds, who's testifying before Representative Shea's subcommittee in Congress today, now as we speak, she will raise the fact that warnings that intelligence uncovered in translating documents, translating recordings made during investigations into drug trafficking, arms trafficking, terrorism activity. It was part of a counterterrorism investigation. She said in April of 2001, the FBI became privy of an operation of a planned attack using planes as weapons and targeting four or five American cities. This was in April 2001. Mm-hmm. And she's someone who's been deemed credible by, you know, someone no less than Senator Grassley and the Senate Judiciary Committee, a Republican. So, you know, here's someone who's been deemed credible by a Republican, the chairman of a committee in the Senate, who's saying she's credible, and what she's saying is the government received intelligence about a planes as weapons attack that was to occur within months, and then it was later confirmed by the same source. And this information was brought to the FBI. The FBI said, don't go there. You know, so, I mean, the evidence is in. The government knew something was coming. And for some reason, they spiked investigations at the FBI field office level. They buried these warnings. They did not act. There was a buzz in town. There was something imminent. It was coming. And they didn't act. We want to know who. And they should be, you know, brought before a proper hearing, before Congress or before a grand jury, and should be grilled about what they knew and when, and until we find out the truth and then bring them to justice. I mean, this is the only solution, and it's the only way out of this mess, in my view, that we're in right now, because 9/11 has been, as you well know, been used as a justification for every manner of travesty against the American people, the shredding of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, projection of military might around the world, justification for increased expenditure, murder of innocents. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. It's all built on the backs of lies, the lies of 9/11.
We'll hopefully have some tape from Sibel Edmonds later this evening on the KBOO News between 5 and 6 regarding her testimony today, just as an aside. And I want to let people know that they're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. Kyle Hentz is my guest. He's the co-founder of 9/11 Citizens Watch, and you can find out more all about them at 911, those are the numerals, 911citizenswatch.org. They have a really expansive website, lots of links to other locations online, document library, etc., etc. So I want to move away from activities congressional, but I also just want to quickly mention that John Conyers, James Oberstar, and Henry Waxman are asking for investigations regarding both the Justice and Transportation Department's roles in the classification and declassification of that FAA report. So there's a bunch of stuff happening. The People Rise Up website at kboo.fm will have links to a whole lot of these documents that we're going to be discussing today in a little bit. I haven't been able to put the site up yet.
Yeah, you also find on our site, Andrew, folks can find the letter that Representative Waxman and Representative Maloney sent to the chairman of the Committee on Government Reform, you know, Mr. Tom Davis. So that was all there, as well as my open letter to Senator Dayton, who has raised some concerns about the NORAD timeline and the lies that NORAD told the American people in the 9/11 Commission.
Well, and then there's also the somewhat recently posted open letter to former security advisor Richard Clark.
Correct. Yeah, there's some questions that I put to him that he refused to answer
four times too. Not even once. That's quite the track record.
Well, four times. Yeah, he had four opportunities to respond, twice by email, and two times in person, and refused to even engage me in a conversation about the issue. And basically goes to the question of, again, a possible perjury situation with Defense Secretary Rumsfeld and General Myers, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, both of whom have said that they were essentially out of the loop during the critical minutes right after the first attacks, and you know, right after they learned of the hijacking, and then of course, you know, after the second strike on the towers, there was no question we were, and they said that they were basically, you know, otherwise disposed in meetings and were not contacted. I mean, it's just absurd claims. And basically Clark's account in his first pages of his book called Against All Enemies basically has them very much in the loop. In fact, he initiates a video conference from the Situation Room in the White House minutes after 9 o'clock. And when they do the roll call, guess what? Both Myers and Rumsfeld are on the video screen.
Maybe it was their doppelganger.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I called Roger Cressy, his deputy at the time. Mm-hmm. He is now running his consulting company called Good Harbor. And I got him on the phone, and I said, you know, what do you remember from that morning? He says, well, I walked in about 9:25, and I remember very clearly Rumsfeld was on the video screen. I mean, folks, you shouldn't dismiss this. I mean, we're talking about people that are running the Pentagon, spending billions, trillions of dollars of our money, who have lied to the American people. There's at least the appearance of that. You know, you have Clark saying they're in, you have Cressy. So either Cressy and Clark are lying, or the commission and Rumsfeld are lying. And, you know, Clark has been proven credible because of the memo that was released saying, you know, which just basically proved his point that, in fact, he did try to warn the administration about the threat that Al-Qaeda posed.
Well, and on a gut level, too, you can just say, who has something to gain, who has nothing to lose? In how they're approaching this?
Well, clearly, they Rumsfeld and Myers have a tremendous amount to lose if it is proven that, in fact, they were in a position of responsibility and that they didn't act and follow standard operating procedure that morning relative to protecting the Pentagon. I think, well, you know, clearly they had that responsibility. They didn't act, and then they tried to cover up and saying, well, they were out of the loop. And I think that question needs to be addressed in Congress. Cynthia McKinney tried to raise the issue of the war games the other day, but I think equally important, you know, there were multiple war games going on that day, which has been elucidated by Michael Rupert and others at FromTheWilderness.com. But this question of what they were doing, I mean, what was the national leadership doing that morning? Why did they insulate President Bush from getting engaged? Why did they have him continue to sit in that classroom reading to the children? Why wouldn't Rumsfeld be immediately brought down to the National Military Command Center and involved in the conference calls and video conference that morning? Well, he was. He says he was.
I want to spend the rest of our time here, which is quickly passing, talking about an article that came out in the course of the past three weeks, both in print and online. Actually, I guess it came out like around the 10th or so of February. Popular Mechanics, owned by the Hearst Corporation, no stranger to what's referred to as yellow journalism from a long time ago, put a piece out effectively smearing the effort of people to uncover what happened on September 11th, the day itself, since, and prior. And from the introduction, which was written by, is it Jim Meigs?
James Meigs. That's correct. He's the editor of Popular Mechanics.
He says, quote, Popular Mechanics compiled a list of the 16 most common claims made by conspiracy theorists, assertions that are at the root of virtually every 9/11 alternative scenario. End quote. And when you flip to the inside, you know, the first heading is the planes. And it's like, okay, well, sure, there's some aspects related to the planes that might be kind of curious. But the first one they broach is this idea that there was some sort of pod underneath one or more of the planes that played some sort of role in the attacks. And not only do I not see the idea of pods on the planes, quote, at the root of virtually every 9/11 alternative scenario, in the 3.5 years I've been looking at this, I don't remember meeting anyone that actually even takes that idea seriously, let alone having it at the root of a scenario.
Yeah, well, this is a clear example of, you know, of a case where if someone wants to discredit a line of inquiry or a growing movement that is shedding light on a cover-up, on a crime, that those behind the crimes will make sure that stories are produced that pick the most specious or the most fringe and most outrageous of theories, most of which are promulgated on the web quite readily, and then use that to discredit the more solid, credible, clear as day bodies of evidence that call a new question the official story or suggest a wider circle of complicity or that the government was infiltrated by whatever, any number of other scenarios. So this is a classic attempt to discredit the good work of very solid journalists and investigative reporters these last few years.
Interestingly, though, they bring up some issues that I personally would like to know more about, but the way they bring it up is not how I would approach it. They look at the issue of, was a stand-down order issued? And it's not even so much that, was there a specific piece of paper that said this, that prevented the military from responding on that morning? The issue is, what was going on with the war games? There didn't need to be a stand-down order as if you could keep enough of the potentially responding military planes doing something else.
Yeah, just for those who are not familiar with this, there were several war games going on that morning, and up to four or five of them.
Yeah, there's five confirmed.
Yes, five confirmed. This was reported by mainstream press. One of them was confirmed by the 9/11 report itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the conjecture is, and it's quite reasonable. In fact, is that these war games involved live-fly hijacking exercises as well as radar injects or inserts. So on the screens at the FAA headquarters, when they're tracking these planes that have been hijacked, reports of hijackings, they were looking at the potential of many more hijackings. And at one point in Clark's book, he recounts the words of Garvey, the FAA administrator Garvey, saying that they had identified nine separate planes. Now, given that there's only eight planes on alert 24 hours, 24/7 on the whole East Coast, they're generally, paired up and sent in pairs to intercept a plane that's off course or its transponder's been turned off. You know, if they had nine and some of them were heading towards cities, it could freeze up the response because, how do you know what's a real plane, what's the real plane that's been hijacked and what's part of some kind of simulation or war game that was going on at the same time. So this has never been addressed by the mainstream press, this extraordinary quote-unquote coincidence of multiple war games that happened to be scheduled on the very morning of the attack.
And actually underway an hour or two before.
That's
correct.
I mean,
it was, it's like the attacks of 9/11 filtered in to these war games that were in process, some of them for more than one day.
That's right. Operation Vigilant Guardian was several days. It was maybe the second or third day in. You have Northern Vigilance. The one that's mentioned in Richard Clark's book, Against All Enemies, is Vigilant Warrior. And Warrior, the designation Warrior, given to a war game, according to Donald Arias, who's the public affairs officer for NORAD, is a designation that means live fly exercise, and it's coordinated in conjunction between in a joint operation between NORAD and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's a very high-level operation. And yet we've not been able to confirm that, in fact, that's gone on. That's why I went to Richard Clark with those questions, that it was an Operation Warrior involving live fly exercises. And it was completely left out of the report, despite the fact that, you know, Clark had a best-selling book. Did the report, did anyone in the commission go into this discrepancies between his accounts and you know, Myers supposedly mentioning this Operation Vigilant Warrior during a video conference that Clark was running? No, they didn't. And why aren't people in Congress saying, okay, they put all this attention into recommendations, enacting recommendations, but, you know, how much attention do we have on the findings of facts and circumstances around the attacks? Virtually nothing. So there's this huge gap there, this huge void, and in that void, a lot of wild conspiracy theories are put out there, including this notion of a pod. I've seen footage not included in the popular documentary that's out there showing the undercarriage of the underbody of the plane as it's heading towards the second tower, and there's nothing attached to that plane. And yet there are tens of thousands of Americans who believe that there was, because they are so jaded and so distrusting of their government that they're willing to, you know, it looks reasonable. It's an optical illusion because of the way the light is on the underside of the plane from certain angles. Other angles don't show it. So anyway, there's a lot of material that needs to be addressed. There's so many omissions and distortions in the 9/11 report. We need to get to the bottom of it. And our group is looking to Spitzer in New York through justicefor911.org. We filed a formal complaint. And, of course, we're lobbying members of Congress. And we may have found a member of Congress to hold at least informal hearings on the Hill.
Well, good. And, you know, the war games is obviously something that I would think as at the core of at least many alternative scenarios of 9/11. Other things that Popular Mechanics chose not to look at is the issue of the insider trading that took place before and during the actual attacks.
That's right.
Above and beyond the stock trades, there were apparently massive amounts of credit card transactions that went through the computers in one of the towers as the attacks were taking place before the towers came down.
Yeah, there was a lot of, I don't know if it was all credit card, but there was a tremendous spike in the volume of, you know, through the pipe, through the data pipe that was going into one of the towers. And, you know, that was going on. You had, you know, two or three days of trading days in which sophisticated investors, people with apparently with inside knowledge, placed put options, which is a bet that a stock will fall. And they placed it on what? United and American.
Hey,
those are the two airlines that were used in the attack the next day.
We got less than a minute to go here.
Okay.
But I just wanted to slip in also that FAA procedures not being followed and then all the foreign intelligence warnings ahead of time. All stuff that, you know, arguably much more at the core of alternative 9/11 scenarios than these pods on the planes that you can't really even see because they're not there.
Yeah,
anyway.
Well, the fact that Popular Mechanics would come out with a piece like this only means that we're onto something. And, you know, by looking at what they ignore, we gain some insight as to where we need to continue to put our focus.
Kyle Hentz is the co-founder of 9/11 Citizens Watch and a board member of 911truth.org. You can find more about 9/11 Citizens Watch online at 911citizenswatch.org. It's the numerals 911. Thank you so much for joining us again, Kyle.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
And off he goes. Per Fagerings coming up next, speaking with Stephen Zunis about situations in the Middle East. If you have any questions or comments, anything you'd like to transmit regarding this or any other program, you can send me email at kboo@riseup.net. The People Rise Up website is available at kboo.fm with a whole lot more news and information about this and many other previous shows. Thanks very much for listening.